And welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, ecology, stories from the land, food justice, fair trade, inspiration, interconnectedness, relationships, and life itself. We're your hosts, Helge Hellberg.
And Mark Mulcahy.
And Sitarani Brian.
And today's show is about being the change from an idea into action. Today we're looking at a few ideas that turned into programs and projects that are changing the world we know today. And all it takes is you or us. Being the change, stories of making a difference. Today on An Organic Conversation. Mark.
Yeah, you know, the great thing about this show is that every day we affect so many people. We don't even know how we affect them just by being ourselves or showing up in the world.
So true. Yes, you're affecting a lot of people.
And I'm going to take that as a compliment.
Absolutely.
It actually reminds me of that car conversation, car commercial from a couple years ago, where somebody sees something that they like and then they smile at somebody, and then that person then like helps a child on the street, and somebody sees them do that, and so they pick something up that somebody dropped.
Oh, yeah.
It just travels across the neighborhood. So it's a reminder that if you start with one good day, it'll affect everybody that you see and everybody that they see and everybody and everybody and everybody. So
yes.
Imagine the power of a good idea.
And I think actually it was an insurance commercial with this beautiful song, Better Days. Yes, amazing. Amazing,
you know what,
commercial.
You know what's amazing, Helge, is that you remember that this was the song in this insurance commercial. That's even more amazing. But before we get into this great show, let's find out what's going on in the world with Jen Lloyd.
Thank you, Mark. The Organic Farming Research Foundation has released a new report that finds the overall demand for organics is supposed to create up to 42,000 green jobs by 2015. While conventional farming has struggled during the recession, growing by just 1% last year, the organic sector grew steadily by 8% in 2010. In order to keep pace, organic farmers are now asking for policy support from the federal government. In early October, a group of activists set out on a 313-mile march demanding genetically modified food labeling on packaged goods in the U.S. Currently in the U.S., there is no requirement to label ingredients as genetically modified. The Right to Know march began in New York City, ending at the White House with rallies each day in hopes to get their message across to the FDA. And the $5 Slow Food Challenge, designed to bring public attention to cooking healthy and affordable options for American families, just got a PR boost from the White House. The Partnership for a Healthier America Challenge, created by Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign, has decided to bring the $5 Slow Food Challenge stage to the White House. On November 29th, the White House chef Sam Cass will host an event promoting healthy and affordable meals made from scratch in hopes of encouraging healthy and sustainable diets for every family. And those are the green headlines. Back to you, Helge.
Thanks, Jen. Jen Lloyd with the green headlines here on An Organic Conversation. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sitarani Brian.
And we'll take a quick break, but stay tuned for our first interview with Ali Lax, the founder of The Gentle Barn, and her inspirational story about how The Gentle Barn gives animals and people a safe place to live and engage, only here on An Organic Conversation. Stay tuned. And we're back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sitarani Brian.
And today's show is about being the change. It seems there are hundreds, maybe thousands of projects that started with a single idea or thought that then turned into action. Actually, when we look closer, though, the whole world, everything people have ever created started this way, from an idea into an action that then inspired others, and it grew from there. Today we're looking at a few programs and projects that started with one single thought by someone somewhere that is now making a true difference in this world. Being the change, stories of making a difference, today on An Organic Conversation. We're excited about our guest today. Our first caller is Ali Lax, founder of The Gentle Barn, calling in from Santa Clarita, California. Ali, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's great. Thanks for making the time. you started the Gentle Barn, which is a place for animals to be safe, but also, and we'll get into that, much more than that, a place for humans to be safe as well. You dreamt of starting the Gentle Barn since you were 7 years old.
Yeah.
How did you come up with that idea? What's the story behind it?
Well, I was one of those strange kids that kept bringing animals home. Birds that fell out of their nests, or ducks that got frozen in the lake, or stray dogs and cats. And I would bring them home, and once I even brought a baby chick home. And my parents were not amused. So they would get rid of them when I was at school, and I'd come home from school and find them gone. It was really upsetting. So I would say to them, you know, how can you do this to me? And they would say, well, when you grow up, you can have as many animals as you like. So I now have 130.
A few years later.
Hi, Ellie. Oh, we're so happy to have you on the show. I'm such a huge fan of the work that you do.
Thank you.
So tell us more. Tell us essentially, what is the Gentle Barn? What are you guys doing down there?
Well, the Gentle Barn does two things. First, we rescue severely abused animals. And what makes us different than other animal rescues is most animal rescues take in the young, healthy, adoptable animals, and their focus is on rehoming. We deliberately go and take the not adoptable animals. We take the animals that are lame or scared, sick or old. Nobody wants them, not even other rescues. And we bring them in and we rehabilitate them. We get the old comfortable, the sick healed, the lame walking again, and the scared trusting again. And once they're healed, and it takes years, but once they're healed, they stay here for the rest of their lives, and then they help us heal abused kids. So we work with kids in foster care, on probation, in gangs, on drugs, and from the inner city, as well as special needs kids and adults.
And what's that exchange that you're observing when animals being rescued that know kind of their, you know, they may be in their last phase of their lives, and yet then they find this oasis of hope with you, a place where they're actually safe, being taken out of their hostile environment. What does that transformation do to the animal?
I mean, it's miraculous. We take in animals that are absolutely terrified. And it kind of reminds me of the saying, waiting to exhale. We basically get in animals that are holding their breath. They are terrified. They don't know what's going to come around the corner. Their bodies are hurting and aching. They've been through the absolute worst. And when they come into the Gentle Barn and they realize that they're safe and we tend to their bodies and make them comfortable, it's almost like they can exhale for the first time in their lives. And they don't have to worry about what's coming around the corner. They can just be in the moment and be happy.
Well, and I have to say, the animals, they look so unbelievably happy. I've seen so many of the videos that you guys put up on YouTube. I love that you guys are out with your cameras and filming the animals having such a good time. People should check this out online and see this amazing recovery.
Well, and hearing you say that, Sita and Ellie, it makes me wonder, the animals, you do a miraculous job with the animals. So what happens to the humans that are interacting with these animals? What is the value in touching an animal? What is the value of interacting with an animal? How are the people changed?
Well, we work with kids that are so shut down and so angry and wounded that traditional therapy often doesn't work with them because they're not going to sit on a couch and tell their life story. And you can also, it's very difficult to talk directly to them because they're just so shut down and so guarded and defensive. But being with an animal, they know the animal's not out to analyze them. They know the animal's not judging them. They know the animal has unconditional love and accepts them for who they are and exactly how they are. So that does an enormous amount just right there. But then also, the stories of the animals are exactly like the stories of the kids that we work with. Stories of neglect, abandonment, being unseen, unheard, misunderstood. You name it. I mean, for every kid, for whatever they've gone through, there's an animal here that's gone through the exact same thing. So when we tell the kids their stories, they see themselves in the animals. And all of a sudden, it's not just kind of a silly old animal. All of a sudden, they're seeing themselves. And so while they're loving and nurturing the animals, they're really kind of healing a part of themselves. And then the animals serve as role models, because if the animals can get through their horrible stories and be loving and forgiving and trusting, then the kids know that they can do that as well.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sita Rani Bryan.
And today on the phone with us, Ellie Lax from The Gentle Barn, the founder of The Gentle Barn, a place as much for battered animals as it is for battered humans. Ellie, beautiful work. How the story today on An Organic Conversation is really how you were inspired, how you were able to grow it. It's the story of being the change from an idea of a seven-year-old that was in love with animals to now really a healing center for animals as much as for humans. What were the challenges that you were experiencing or that you are still experiencing in your work daily and overall for the project? And how do you cope with that?
I think early on, the two major hurdles were financial and just the pain of losing animals. You know, we'd rescue an animal, we'd try so hard to save them, and sometimes there are animals that come into our place not to live but to die, a dignified death in the arms of someone who loves them instead of alone. That was very challenging early on because it hurt. It hurt to lose animals. And there was even a point early on where I said, you know what, I can't do this work. It's just too hard. It's too painful. I let someone else do it. It's just too hard for me. But because the Gentle Barn was my dream since I was seven, and because really it's really the only thing that I can see myself doing, I got over that moment pretty quickly, and I said, okay, I'm going to have to accept this pain and accept this as part of my work, but I'm going to have to trudge on and do my work anyway.
And Ellie, listening to you, I'm sitting here almost with tears in my eyes. Mm-hmm. The love that's coming out through this conversation is how do you, you know, when most of us try to start projects, you know, we often have days of doubt. We often have days of, like you had already said, that, you know, I don't want to do this work anymore. How do you get past that?
I think there was a part of me that knew I had to be stronger than that. I couldn't just give up because it was hard. That's just not a legitimate excuse. It hurts. Yeah, it's painful. Yeah, it's hard. But get up, dust yourself off, and keep going. I didn't want to be the person that gave up because of those reasons.
But what's your community of thought, of people, of like what tools do you use if you had to give somebody advice that wanted to start their own project? You know, the show is all about encouraging others to recognize their uniqueness and whatever they may be interested in, be animals or you know, communities, or it doesn't really actually matter what you get your fingers in. There's a place for you where you will make a difference. What's your advice for somebody who is thinking about starting their own thing?
Yeah, actually, I give the same advice to the kids that we work with. Basically, I don't believe that we're here to suffer. I believe that we're here to find ourselves, to live our dreams, and be happy. And so if there is something in our hearts that we know we're supposed to be doing, don't take no for an answer. Don't give up. Keep problem solving until we can have it, because this is why we're here.
Now, Sita, you've always, you brought this project to us.
Yeah.
Can you tell us quickly?
Yeah. Well, I'm a member. I support this because I think it's so important. And Ellie, I'm so very grateful for the work you're doing. I think it's amazing and it's courageous. And thank you for doing it. Can you tell us how people can get involved to help support your project?
Yeah. Oh, there's so many ways. If people happen to live out in Santa Clarita, they can come and volunteer. But even if people are far away, they can become members of the Gentle Barn, so they know that a small amount of money is going to feed our animals. They can sponsor an animal, so they can go to our website, which is gentlebarn.org, and they can go to our virtual barn and see the pictures and stories of all our animals. And then they can look for an animal that touches their heart, and they can become a sponsor of that animal. So they know that the funds are going to take care of that animal, and plus they get monthly updates and emails and new pictures every month about that animal, and they get to just be part of an animal's life and know that they're contributing to their healing.
So that's the support side. How do people get involved that would like to, you know, be in your care in that sense, that would like to be part of a program?
Oh, you mean like special needs kids or at-risk kids?
Yes, for example.
Oh, yeah, just call us. And you know, I talk mainly about the kids, but we work with battered women shelters, we work with homeless men, we work with Vietnam vets, we work with seniors, we work with Alzheimer's, we work with burn centers, terminally ill patients. Any kind of affliction, doesn't matter what anyone is going through, there is healing here because there's unconditional love and there's a furry body that's waiting to help you.
And then lastly, talking about furry bodies, how do they qualify? If pigs are listening right now, and you know, in all seriousness, if there's an animal that is battered or in a really unhealthy living situation, how do people refer animals to you?
So if someone knows of an animal that's being treated unjustly, unfortunately, the first step is they have to go through the animal shelter because we're not licensed to go into someone's home and take their animal away. So the first job is to get the animal removed from that abusive situation. So the animal control or the police are going to have to help in that way. But if for some reason there is an animal that's suffering that no other rescue will take that they have removed from the owners, then yeah, that's an animal that has our name on it, basically.
And you still have capacity? I'm sure that's it's an ongoing balance between funding, capacity, and your willingness to take all this on, but certain limitations based on size and space. Is that a challenge, or are you saying the doors are open no matter what?
I'm actually saying both. It is a challenge because, you know, eventually with every rescue, there's going to be a time where you're full. And, of course, so it definitely depends on space and our funding. So that's why it's so important that people support us. But also, if there's an animal out there that we know for sure there is just no one else that's going to take, the other rescues won't take them, no one is going to adopt them, and we know that we can fix that animal, we're going to make room.
And we're glad you are doing that. Ellie Lax, the founder of The Gentle Barn, a rescue center for animals and a safe place for animals as well as for humans. Thanks for your work, Ellie. And yes, absolutely inspirational. Thank you.
Thanks for making a difference.
We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helga Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sita Rani Bryan.
And we're looking at Being the Change today, stories of making a difference. More of that, more inspiring, very moving stories when we come back right after the break. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a sec.
And giving your thanks to our seas, my respect to the ones in the forest, standing up for our old trees, them giving food to the hungry, hope to the needy.
My name is Earl Herrick, and I am the owner of Earl's Organic Produce, a San Francisco Bay Area distributor fully committed to organic produce. From the time one could find organic fruits and vegetables only in natural food stores to now, when schools and fine restaurants feature organic, we have been forging relationships with growers for over 20 years. If you want to offer the finest organic produce to your employees or customers, find us at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Fry Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Trace, the new signature restaurant at the W San Francisco, is committed to creating an enriching and thoughtful culinary experience. By fusing the vibrant local personality of the Bay Area with a dedication to socially responsible food, Trace ensures all the ingredients are traceable back to their natural origins, locally sourced and sustainable. For reservations, visit trace-sf.com, trace-sf.com, or call 415-817-7836.
Bowman College has been offering professional training in nutrition and the culinary arts since 1989. Natural chefs will learn to master a healthful approach to classic culinary techniques, while nutrition consultants become experts in client consultation and the promotion of individualized plans for optimal health. Bowman College, a leader in the field of holistic nutrition and culinary arts. To find out more, visit bowmancollege.org. That's B-A-U-M-A-N college.org.
Thank you.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sitarani Brian.
And today it's about being the change, stories and projects that are making a difference that started with one single person and one single idea. We heard from Ellie Lax from The Gentle Barn, a safe place for animals as well as for humans. And on the phone with us now is Britta Riley from an amazing project that she started, growing food indoors. But before we go to Britta, here's our weekly update from Mark Mulcahy with what's in season. Mark, what's in season?
And what's in season are Asian apple pears. For most of us, when we think of fall, we think of pumpkins and squash and greens and things like that. But Asian apple pears, this is right when they're really starting to get good and when they're starting to be in most of the stores around the country. Now, Asian apple pear, people often ask me, they say, well, is it a pear or is it an apple? And actually, it's not an apple pear or a pear apple. It's simply just a different type of pear that was originally cultivated in China and Japan. And the great thing about these pears is that even though they always seem like they're as hard as a rock when you find them in a store, they actually bruise really easily. So you have to really treat them just like any other fruit, very gently. And when you're looking for them, even though they're hard, they're ripe when they're firm. So they don't give you any of that, like a little bit of, you know, gentle break to them. That you have to smell them, and you have to make sure that you have them out of the refrigerator, because you won't get that ripe smell from them when they're cold. So that's a little tip there. And a really key thing about Asian pears is when I tell people about Asian pears, they say, oh, I've had an Asian pear before. And yet there are so many varieties of Asian pears. The 20th century is the most popular one grown that is sold in this country. And it tastes like a combination of apples and citrus. It's very juicy and watery. But there are lots of Asian pears. There's Hoshuis and Kochuros and Shinsekis. And they look similar. They may be, some might be gold, some might be russeted, some might be a little green. But their flavors are just wonderfully different. These Asian apple pears can have a flavor that is like honey, like walnuts. Some are as fragrant as flowers. Some have a vanilla undertone. And some are buttering, almost caramel flavor that you just wonder if you're eating a caramel apple. So make sure that when you go to the store that you ask your produce person or at the farmer's market what variety it is. So, 'cause as you taste them, you're going to find the one that really you like. And it will really make a difference in the end. And we can thank the gold rush for having these Asian apple pears in our country, because the Chinese gold miners who came over from China to find gold planted these back in the 1800s in California. And then they proliferated throughout the rest of the country. So that's today's What's in Season.
Thank you, Mark. Asian pears, who knew? Today on An Organic Conversation, we are talking about being the change, making stories of making a difference. And we heard again from The Gentle Barn, an animal rescue place, and we are now going into growing food at home. With us is Britta Riley, the founder of Window Farms. She started the Window Farms project just a few years ago, and she's joining us today on An Organic Conversation. Britta, are you with us?
I am with you. Hello.
Thank you. You're calling from Brooklyn, New York, if you're not traveling right now. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm actually joining you all from Union Square Park right now. I'm sitting in the middle of a beautiful day. So if you hear lots of birds chirping and, you know, honking, that's what it is.
Yes, and how appropriate. It's about urban farming in the most domestic sense. You started Window Farms Project by showing people, being inspired by showing people how to grow food inside their homes. And it doesn't take much. You have been part of sustainable designs as part of your profession and studies for many years. But what started the idea to launch Window Farms? What's the story behind it?
Sure. Well, I had been working with some museums and had been learning more and more about, you know, some of the food security issues and so forth. And I came upon one of Michael Pollan's wonderful articles, and he made the argument that growing at least some of one's own food is one of the best things that we can do for the environment right now as Americans. And at the time that I was reading this article, I lived in a fifth-floor walk-up in Brooklyn with no balcony, no access to dirt whatsoever, and it was the middle of the winter. So I just thought, wow, there are billions of us around the world who are in this situation of living in cities and really not having the resources to grow traditionally. So I was determined to figure out how I could just use the light that was coming in through my window, use the fact that I had indoor climate control year-round, and just tinker with the technology of hydroponics and make that viable for food growing in cities.
And yes, you are, of course, hitting a very important point. As of last year, for the first time ever in human evolution, we have more people living in cities around the world than in rural areas. Give us a visual, Sita.
Yeah. Hi, I was curious. This is such an innovative idea. And I think for so many people, it's really out of the box that they can't envision what this looks like. What does it look like to have a window farm in your home? How does that whole thing come together? What's the visual?
And with that, what's hydroponic? If you can explain that to some of our listeners who may not be absolutely sure about what that is.
Yeah, absolutely. So hydroponics is a fundamentally different way of growing from growing in soil. The idea is that you're abstracting the physical properties of soil and having the plant's roots sit in something like clay pellets that don't have any nutritional value. And instead, you're actually running using usually a water pump or an air pump to move liquid through. You're moving this liquid nutrient solution, which is basically something akin to a compost tea, through the plant's root system. So they're actually growing in water. And by designing a system just for those constraints, you can get really great aeration. And by thinking very strategically about what it is that you're putting in there and what kind of nutrients you're providing, you can deliver amazingly good nutrition to these plants.
And so back to Sita's question, when you look at your design, it's really best described as five large plastic water bottles stuck together upside down, so that the cap end, the small end, or the small top is at the end, funneling the nutrients into the next bottle, and they're all stuck together. And can you give the best visual you can possibly give on the radio?
Sure. Yes, this is always a challenge because when we talk about all those materials, it sounds like a mess, but they actually end up looking really beautiful. So imagine a bunch of water bottles, and when you stick them all together end to end, they almost look like beads, but there are holes cut out of them, and the plants actually grow out of these holes. And then down at the bottom, one of these water bottles is being used as a reservoir to hold this liquid nutrient solution, which is kind of like it's like a tea-colored liquid. And there's a little clear tube that runs up the side. And when the pump turns on, that sends some of this water up to the top of the system, and then it trickles down through all the plant's root system. So they look something between a hanging garden and a fountain, and kind of people have called them like window curtains of plants.
And so if people really want to get a visual, of course, the best way is to go to windowfarms.org, your website, windowfarms.org. And you started this project when? In 2009, right? Just a couple of years ago.
Right.
And I believe you now have over 20,000 window farmers that are following you and that are using your methods and your design to grow some food at home.
Now, so Britta, I'm sitting here going, okay, many people read Michael Pollan. Many people are inspired by what he says. You came up with a system that sits on people's windows in Brooklyn or in cities all around the world. So my first question is, where does that thought process come in that created this window farm? And the second question for you is, once you came up with the idea, how many times did it take for you to fail to then start up again to actually get it to where it is now?
Yeah, well, I actually actually, so one of my approaches to coming to this was I had been working in the technology industry for a long time as a technology designer, both for physical products and for things online. And I really fell in love with the idea of open source. So the way that some software is developed for free by thousands of people around the world collaborating on it and basically replicating something almost that it would take a Microsoft to build. But because you have so many different people working on it and testing it and making their own tweaks, you end up getting something that is a really, really robust product that serves a lot of different people. So I decided to take the same approach. And once I'd come up with the original prototype, I put those designs on the internet and people could download them. And then I built a website around that that lets people come back and share outcomes that they've had or notice how they had to tweak it to make it fit their circumstances. And so together we have actually gone through about 12 different design iterations for this system and been able to test it in Hong Kong and Senegal and all over the world and know that we've really got something that is a workable system for people all over the place.
And what kind of food are you growing, just to give people, how much food can be grown this way?
Well, you're definitely not going to grow enough to sustain a human being. In fact, it takes many, many, many acres for us to grow enough vegetables using the traditional methods to actually sustain ourselves. So this is really just taking, you know, we encourage people to take a stab at some of that stuff that you go to the grocery store all the time to get, the basil, the lettuce. The kale during the middle of the fall season. So you can grow up to about 32 vegetable plants in a typical 4x6 window, which seems to be the most common size. And if you play your cards right and you really think like a farmer about how you're using that real estate to give you the best nutritional bang for your buck, you can actually grow quite a bit of nutritional, like kale and some of that fresh produce, and really supplement yourself with stuff that you're eating that is still alive at the time that you are harvesting it.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sitarani Brian.
And today we're looking at Being the Change, Stories of Making a Difference. With us on the phone from Brooklyn, New York is Britta Riley. Actually, not Brooklyn. You are in New York, New York. Is that right?
Yes.
You're in New York City.
I'm in Union Square Park right now.
Yes. Color me jealous. I've been a city girl for such a long time. I moved from New York about 4 years ago, and I know exactly where you're sitting. I know exactly what you're looking at. If it was a farmer's market day, you would be swinging by Red Jacket Orchard and get, like,
yes,
you know, nice apple
right
juice.
Oh, my God. Market.
Yeah. So I want to ask you, how has your life changed as a result of this project? I mean, this is huge, really exciting and important work, but what's your life like now that this project is really launched and you've got 20,000 plus window farmers?
Yeah, it has. You know, honestly, it has been so amazing, and it's been a really tough process. So I consider myself to be a social entrepreneur, someone who is, you know, determined to create a financially sustainable business to fund this project. And, you know, scaling up any new business is a challenge, but especially if you're really committed to, you know, holding truth to some ethics and to, you know, doing some work that's contributing back. And to do that and get a business off the ground, it takes a lot of work, and it takes, you know, having a really great community around me. So I have had to go through a little bit of a change of not being so determined to do everything myself, and I've really had to open myself up and welcome help from other people to make sure that this gets done the right way.
Yes, and that's difficult for people who like to be in control, like me. I can relate.
Yeah.
But Britta, today's show is about being the change and how it can start from one idea, how it can turn into action. I would say that it was never more supported, this kind of thinking, the you know, social entrepreneurialism that you are describing. I know you got some seed money from Kickstarter, and if people don't know what it is, it's literally a website that was set up for projects like this, and it could be, you know, your personal music CD to a video documentary to a social entrepreneurial project such as yours. any kind of great idea can be put up on Kickstarter, or any not so great idea as well. And then people can decide if they want to contribute $1 or $3 or $5 or $1,000. And money raised on Kickstarter ranges anywhere from $500 to, I believe, far over $100,000 that people have raised for their projects, really just supported by the community at large. Anyone can go there and say, I like this, I'm going to give $1 or $10. You got some seed money from there. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true. We so the money for us to launch our do-it-yourself kit business, we raised $28,000, which I think is still the highest grossing
wow.
food project on Kickstarter, and that was in the beginning of 2010. And that was really just, for the most part, people just saying, hey, I really want to see this become a sustainable business. And we're about to launch our second Kickstarter campaign in early November, in which we're actually launching pre-sales of our first new product that we actually designed from the ground up with some furniture designers. Basically be a beautiful version of the window farms that doesn't involve water bottles.
And can you at this point make a living? Like, can you at least support yourself doing this, or is every dollar going straight into the project externally?
Yeah, every dollar is pretty much still going into the project externally. We've almost hit our kind of break-even point a couple of times, but we're really committed to getting something out there that doesn't require people to be handy. And to do that, you know, we had to invest in some, you know, mass production tools
sure. And
so forth. So,
but so how,
yeah, we're
how do you
still
support,
trying to break even.
How do you support yourself for the last 2 years?
Well, it's been a lot of, you know, being really cheap and relying on my friends. I actually funded this largely with money from my last business as well. So, I mean, that's part of being an entrepreneur is being able to scale down your lifestyle for a couple of years.
And what's the biggest advice as a final question you can give to anyone walking around with this burning in their chest and this idea that they don't know if it could ever work, but they really would love to do it? What's, you know, despite all the challenges and what you've experienced, what's your greatest advice that you could give somebody?
We are just embarking on an era of new creativity and experimentation. I think that that's a movement that's spreading right now. And so if you can give up any ego that, you know, kind of tries to come in there and trying to be a control freak, let it go and let people collaborate with you, and you will get so much farther.
Britta Riley, the CEO and founder of the Window Farms Project, joining us today from New York City, New York. Again, more information on windowfarms.org. Wonderful work, Britta. Thanks for joining us today. Pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Britta.
Good luck with the project. Amazing.
Thanks a lot.
Oh. Being
I'm
the change.
So
I love it.
Inspired, my goodness.
Me too.
The commitment.
This is perfect, and it's the perfect time to let Sita rain her inspiration on us with her weekly update. He is Chef Sita with Your Holistic Bite.
I it's so fun to talk about recipes after hearing all these things that people do, because it's like it's creating things. It's getting inspired, and it's being willing to try a new recipe and have it fail and try it again and just, you know, change somebody's life with a delicious bite. So today we're talking about delicious bites of Asian pear. And I remember the very first time I had an Asian pear, I don't really know what I was expecting, but I was so shocked when I tried it because it doesn't really taste like a pear. And actually, I kind of think it tastes a little bit like grape ices, which is, you should see the look on Mark's face right now. When I tried it, it tasted like, you know, those little freeze pops you had when you were a kid, except it was a really healthy version of it. And I loved it. And its texture is so interesting because it's, I don't want to say it's mealy because I think that turns a lot of people off, but it has this textural element that is really different than the silkiness and smoothness that you get from other pears. Grittiness. Mark is like, the technical term is grittiness or graininess. There we go. All right. Drawing from my produce expert here. But I, you know, I usually give a recipe on Holistic Bite. I want to just challenge everybody who's listening who has never had an Asian pear to try a raw Asian pear. Go get one, let it ripen on your counter, and then just simply try it and get to understand and like it for what it is. And I, you know, when I teach at Bowman, that's what I always tell the students too, is you have to know what the raw ingredient tastes like before you can start working with it. So Asian pears, you know, as Mark was saying, they are pears. So their nutrition profile is very similar. They're rich in that mineral I talked about when we did Bartlett's boron, which is great at protecting the loss of calcium from your body. They're also hypoallergenic. So if you have difficulty with, you know, other food sensitivities and fruits, you usually do fine with pears and Asian pears too. They're also a really great source of fiber. The pectin in it, I mean, excellent, excellent for fiber. And if you're looking for another, maybe more delicious way to put fiber into your yogurt, cut up an Asian pear this week. So, and those of you who do like a recipe, I'm not going to leave you high and dry and just say eat a raw Asian pear. Why don't you try putting together an Asian pear crumble with crushed pine nuts and a little bit of ground ginger? Doesn't that sound exotic and lovely? I think that as the weather is getting colder and you want something warm, this is really soul satisfying. And it's really healthy because, you know, it's mostly just a combination of some sauteed pears and some ground pine nuts, ginger, a little bit of coconut oil, a little bit of flour and sugar. But, you know, you could have it for breakfast as well as dessert. So check out that recipe on our website, inorganicconversation.com, or on Facebook, the Asian Pear Crumble with Crushed Pine Nuts. And that is your Holistic Bite.
Thank you, Chef Sita. And Sita, you threw in Bowman. That's, of course, Bowman College. Chef Sita, Sitarani Brian, is the program director of Bowman College, now a host on An Organic Conversation. And Bowman College being the finest culinary arts and holistic nutrition school in the United States. For more information, bowmancollege.org. If you're interested in making food in any way, or shape or form your profession, go to BaumanCollege.org. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sitarani Brian.
And you're listening to An Organic Conversation. We have a fantastic guest lined up, Emma Kerwin, who started an organization that addresses social justice in faraway places, just based on an idea and her experiences hiking in those areas as we are looking at being the change, stories of making a difference here on An Organic Conversation. All that and more when we come back right after the break. Stay tuned.
Frye Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frye never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Frye organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Frye Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at fryewine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Produce is ever-changing, seasons coming and going. At Earls Organic, we have been sourcing solely organic produce for over 20 years. Since 1988, Earls Organic Produce has been establishing strong relationships with growers and developing a deep understanding of the seasons, so you can offer the most delicious organic produce to your customers, staff, and clients year-round. For organic produce, visit Earls Organic Produce at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Are you interested in making healthy food your profession? Bowman College is a leader in the field of holistic nutrition and culinary arts. Their professional training programs prepare individuals for successful careers as nutrition consultants and natural chefs. Study at one of four locations in California and Colorado, or learn from home in a self-paced mentor distance learning program. Find out more about their classes on holistic nutrition and culinary arts at BaumanCollege.org. That's B-A-U-M-A-N College.org.
Trace, the new signature restaurant at the W San Francisco, is committed to creating an enriching and thoughtful culinary experience. By fusing the vibrant local personality of the Bay Area with a dedication to socially responsible food, Trace ensures all the ingredients are traceable back to their natural origins, locally sourced and sustainable. For reservations, visit trace-sf.com, T-R-A-C-E-S-F.com, or call 415-817-7836.
And welcome back to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sitarani Brian.
And today we're talking about being the change, stories of making a difference. We had some very inspiring guests with us today and are now joined by Emma Kerwin, the executive director and co-founder of Peaks Over Poverty, calling in from Norwalk, Connecticut. Emma, are you with us?
I am with you.
Thanks for joining us today. We are all glowing right now. We are inspired by the stories of the Window Farm Project, Growing Food at Home, and the Gentle Barn, a safe place for animals and humans alike, that we had on the show earlier today. You are taking social justice into a completely new realm, Peaks Over Poverty, really based on your love of hiking and the kind of environmental and social injustices that are often connected with that. Tell us about the story. What's the idea behind it? How did this come about?
So a strong part of the Peaks Over Poverty story is also based on food and agriculture, which is a long passion of mine and has also dictated, you know, what I've studied in school and where I've worked. So I was working in the Ecuadorian Andes with a small nonprofit called Eco Rural. And Eco Rural works with family farmers to help them improve their health and income through sustainable agriculture. And they really, really help transform people's lives and also revive the very fragile highland ecosystems that they live in. So, for example, I'll tell you a quick story about a family from the northern Andes, which is a region that was once covered in glaciers and now is a complete desert. This one family, Alfonso and Olga, the parents, were so poor that they lived on $1.50 a day, and they couldn't grow anything from their land. They couldn't feed their family. And Eco Rural worked with the family to help them untap underground water sources and then build water storage tanks and irrigation systems with free or recycled materials like homemade cement, used tires for water tanks, used PVC pipes for irrigation tubes. And the family started to teach their neighbors what they'd learned. And slowly this community transformed into literally a desert in the middle of an oasis. And they're now, they've doubled their income, they're growing food to feed their family, they're selling at the market, and wow, have completely transformed how they live.
So that is... That inspired you then? Was that the inspiration for Peaks Over Poverty? Was this?
Well, this is one of the many inspirations that I found daily working with Eco Rural. And one of the major issues when I was there was, I went in 2007 and I stayed in Ecuador until 2009. And this was when the financial crisis hit. So like most small nonprofits, Eco Rural was struggling to survive, and that jeopardized the 10,000 plus farmers they were working with throughout the Andes.
Sure.
So,
Yes, sure. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, so the inspiration came from, you know, how can we make sure that Eco Rural and their small team of people have the funding to continue providing these services? And also being an avid hiker and outdoors person, I was out with a few colleagues hiking, you know, outfitted in our North Face gear and high-tech boots and passing by all these farming communities, which, you know, it's just what you see when you're on a hike. And we started thinking about, you know, how could we raise money by doing this? Do you think we could ask our friends and family to donate $1 for every foot that we hike? And, you know, it made complete sense. I mean, the trails that we were on were what farmers used to get to their fields or herd livestock. They weren't maintained by a national park system or, you know, it was very much connected, and the connection had never been, at least to me, so clear. And that snowballed into the realization that hundreds of tourists are pouring into Ecuador every day to do just the same thing, little awareness about the people living there, and all these people have money to spend. So Peaks Over Poverty really emerged out of a way to build a connection between tourists and local communities, and then empower local communities to continue improving their lives with support from small nonprofits like Eco Rural.
And is that still the funding model, that basically you find sponsors that give you a certain amount of money, a dollar or so, for tourists that come in for literally every mile you hike?
That is the kind of a founding model, and that's how we encourage people to give back to Eco Rural, by trying to get sponsors to support them for every foot that they hike. But we try not to be too detailed about how people, exactly, because, you know, then people get worried, well, I'm climbing a 20,000 foot mountain, it's going to be really hard to raise $20,000 from one person. So, you know, any money helps, and that's what we encourage people to do, is just to actually merge goal with the fundraising piece.
Great, yes.
And Emma, when I was looking at your website and looking at the project and was very impressed with what you're doing, I was noticing that there are other ways that you are helping to support this project too, that people who don't climb or who don't know people who are climbing can get involved in this as well, right?
Yes, so actually... Exactly. We tell people, you know, because the first concern was, well, I'm not a climber. Can I still raise money? Of course. So people they've run for this cause. Now we're trying to actually not only just include Eco Rural, but expand our web platform as a tool that other nonprofits can use to also raise money. And people can, they've created their own challenges, and people can also create their own challenges to give back. So one example is in Ithaca, New York, where I'm actually calling from today, there's an organization called Ithaca Community Harvest, and they help farmers harvest surplus crops from their field, and then those crops get brought into low-income schools as healthy snack programs for youth. So they're asking people to do a harvest challenge where they actually go out and help harvest, raise money by doing that, and then the food gets donated to the school.
So, Emma, today's show is about being the change, really walking around as change agents. Whether that's good change or not so good change is really up to us, by recognizing what we can do in our individuality. We got the story of what kind of prompted for you to start Peaks Over Poverty. If people are listening, it's the question that we asked all guests today. I'm sure there were lots of struggles and challenges every day that you encounter in your work. What is holding you up? How do you do this work and keep doing it every day? What's the greatest advice you could give somebody if he or she, if they wanted to start their own project and are listening to the show? What have you learned the most?
Well, the greatest, I think that the most motivating moments for us and for me have been moments like this, like being invited to participate on this radio show is incredibly inspiring and makes me think, okay, well, there's other people out there who believe in this idea and think this is a worthy cause and want to get involved. So I think that, you know, if you're committed to starting something new or being the change, that you need to talk about it and tell people what you're doing and tell people your story, because that's what people want to hear. How did you get to this point? Why do you want to do this? And then give them a way to act. And by talking, you spread the word and find these moments of inspiration.
I love that.
Other people.
I love that, Emma. That's so great. I think it's really important when you're doing a startup, when you're doing something where there are a lot of struggles, that you celebrate those little wins, that you find something to say, oh, yeah, this made it worthwhile. Like, we're so honored that you think being on this show for you was a win. That's really great.
It's a win for us, too.
I love this idea of ecotourism to benefit the communities that you're visiting. I think it's really important work, and we just feel really honored to showcase it. So thank you.
Absolutely, Emma. So tell us how people can get involved in your projects. You know, what you mentioned, some of the things that, you know, don't necessarily have to do with climbing that other people can do. So how can people get involved?
So people can launch a challenge, which is a way, what I say is find or identify that thing in your life that you love. Everyone has a passion. Everyone has a hobby. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. So how can we use that passion as a vehicle for change? And that's exactly what we try to do with our web platform is, you know, if you love cooking, why don't you host a dinner and ask everyone who comes to donate $25 to Eco Rural or one of the causes that we support on our website.
And what's what's that website, Emma? Can you tell the website one more time?
The website is www.peaksoverpoverty.org.
And there's lots of information, great photos, beautiful imagery of your work, and lots of creative ways of how people can get involved. Again, that's peaksoverpoverty.org. Emma Kerwin, thank you for your work. Thanks for being part of the show today. An honor and a pleasure to have you, and for you too to be on our show. So,
thank you so much.
It works
me.
In both ways. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks, Emma.
Okay,
take care.
Take care.
Wow. Well, Helga, I have to say that after all this inspiration, if you don't have an amazing organic moment today, I don't know. But
actually,
do you have one?
Inspiration was today came from all the way from Abu Dhabi. We got an email from Aaron, an avid listener who found our show just a couple months ago from the United Arab Emirates. Emailing us how much he enjoyed our show and how much there's apparently the sustainability movement is not quite as advanced there yet in Abu Dhabi, but she really feels like when she listens to our show with her newborn child in her arm that she's listening to a bunch of friends talking about hope and inspiration. So that was great. Thanks,
Aaron,
for that.
That is what we do all day.
Yes.
Right? Friends.
Mm-hmm. And yes, Helga's organic moment. It's fall season, time for tea or hot chocolates, books to read that you didn't get to, perhaps more sleep, some writing, a time of darkness, transformation, contemplation, slowing down and resting to speed up again next spring. And it's the time of beeswax candles. I love candles, and I'm in awe of the process that each beeswax candle is part of. It goes like this. Bees harvest pollen, which is sunlight converted by the plants, and then brings this pollen into the beehive, where it gets turned into honey or wax. So in a way, wax literally is the extension of sunlight made available through the wonderful work of bees. And this extension of sunlight is made humanity possible. Everything before just, 130 years ago or so in 1880, when Edison invented the light bulb, was lit by candles. For thousands of years, bees illuminated the night for us. Every poem ever written at night was written with the light of a beeswax candle. Interestingly, in all this, the bees that made wax actually are worker bees that stay inside the hives and never see the daylight. So the very bees that are most responsible for extending the sunlight for us never get to see what illumination means. And they do it anyway. So whatever your role is in life, do it, live it, because it matters, even if the illumination about the importance of it is not directly apparent. So thank you to all bees, always, and a happy fall season to all of us.
Thanks, Helga. It just reminds me that even if you don't climb mountains or if you haven't started your own business, that there is something for you to do out there that we all can do, right?
Absolutely. Yes, great show.
I'm just thinking about something that I thought at the very beginning, which is that when you have a good idea, there's so much power behind it. If you give yourself the opportunity to share that with people, you don't know how far it's going to go. It could change so many lives. So,
and life conspires around good ideas.
Oh,
always.
Yeah, absolutely.
It when you will come.
Definitely, I believe when you decide on the right course of life, then the rest of the world will conspire to make it happen for you.
Absolutely. Yes. Well, that was this week's edition of An Organic Conversation.
An Organic Conversation is a production of the Organic Media Network. Associate producer is Kristen Ponger. Production assistants are Lauren Mulcahy and Vanessa Farron.
If you missed parts of this show or for any other episodes, go to iTunes or anorganicconversation.com.
We're your hosts, Helga Hellberg,
Mark Mulcahy,
and Sitarani Bryan.
And we'll be back next week, right here, same place, same time. See you then.
Bye-bye now.
Bye. An image of you and of me, and we're laughing with love at it all. Look at our life now. Tattered and torn, we fuss and we fight.